His concluding story, however, allows him both more density and more room. It gives him just enough tools to show us the kind of authoritative, vocally limber, and devastating writer he can be. The aptly, inevitably named Rich is marrying the well-to-do Ginny at a Loire Valley chateau straight out of a Three Musketeers movie. But first, back home, in his prenuptial ambivalence, he contemplates an affair with Nora. Nora was his only client. Nora's happiness was his full-time job. She wasn't Ginny. She was someone else. She could die tomorrow. He didn't care. This loveless union is consummated, briefly for Rich, at length for the reader, and the five pages documenting the coupling are among the few deeply merciless passages in Clem's book. Some of her lipstick had come off. She grabbed the back of his head and jacked it toward her. Her own head moved forward steadily, like a shark's head, like a prosthetic limb, some football wrapped in baloney. She threw her tongue down his throat like a waterlogged sneaker. The scene continues somewhat pathologically and at length from there. This is not really misogyny, at least I don't think it is, but panic and loss of appetite served up as sick hilarity. During the last few moments, Rich had begun hoping that a crazy person would break in and beat them to death with the spade beside Nora's writhing head. Its gruesomeness casts a deliberate shadow across the entire subsequent story, much like the mammoth hurricane that keeps most of the guests from being able to attend the wedding, and the marriage of Rich and Ginny that proceeds regardless in another country entirely, must gather together what few genuine consolations can be fashioned or found. The story's other two perspectives belong to Ginny and to an ominous, dissipated old German friend of her mother's, Emil Marcus, who comes to the wedding because he has a real affinity for repulsive American overkill and, unbeknownst to Ginny, believes himself to be her biological father. Ginny herself is one of Clem's typical young women, too intent on doing good in the world and on losing weight at the same time, to screw up the energy to leave Clem's difficult males. Besides, Clem has made largely sympathetic company of his childish men by making them smart. In both meanings, he inflicts pain on them and makes them bright. And so, the night Rich arrives in France and asks, "Why are we doing this?" Meaning, unpacking the contents of the suitcases into the dresser, both misunderstanding and understanding all too well, Ginny sums it up for him. "Because we're desperate and we're lonely, and nothing better came along. You're all I've got now, and you'd better get used to it. We're on the grown-up train, and we don't get off until the graveyard." Rich held up his folded shirts. He said he was talking about the clothes. For the rest of the story, Ginny attends to a pedicure, throws up her meal, worries about Somalia, and wonders why her mother's European family had to leave France after the Nazi occupation was over. Clem's radar, or perhaps one should say nose, is for all that is unclean, especially money. In the end, his book is a reminder that the wealth of the American upper middle class and the suburban materialism of its lifestyle is not old news, already sufficiently taken up by literary writers of previous decades. In the excessive ways it is experienced now, American affluence is unprecedented, socially and globally isolating, in a manner that is new, overwhelming, and sinister to those looking on. Clem speaks from within this affluent milieu, but in his stories is dividedly looking on, and askance, in the manner of a houseguest or an in-law. Sometimes his characters are quite literally that, wrestling with his own scathing criticism, his own generation-specific nausea, his own particular patios and poolsides, until politeness can no longer be managed, nor righteous rudeness subdued. Throughout his work, he steadily reveals his complicated interest in all that revolts, in both senses of the word. One could argue that the bursts of indignation are too intermittent, their effect somehow decorative, and therefore not finally the strongest current in any of the narratives. The strongest current may simply be the kind of animal desire for peace and sleep. All the characters move in that direction at story's end, which, gussied up, can look like forgiveness or benevolence instead of the exhaustion that it is. After all, Clam has brilliantly reminded us all along, from the book's title forward, that even tucked between pillows and track lights, we are nothing but animals. Repeatedly electrocuted by a fence, we will tire and stay in the yard. But only then. 2000. Legal aid. My first job. In the 1970s, a new paraprofession was getting a foothold in urban law firms, that of the legal assistant or paralegal, and some college graduates, uncertain how to pay the rent or fund their art, were venturing into this day job. In New York, these jobs paid slightly better than entry-level publishing positions, but involved a level of exploitation that had actually caused the paralegals at one prominent Manhattan firm to strike. Upon graduation from college, fresh from editing the school literary magazine, perplexed at the number of people I knew going in an automatic fashion to law school, when I asked them what it was a lawyer did exactly, none of them could say, I entered this strange professional racket. I would find out what a lawyer did exactly. Others I knew at the time who also embarked on this pursuit included a woman with a just-completed master's thesis on Carlyle's Sartor Resartus, who promptly used her employer's legal services to change her last name from Schmunk, and a high school teacher with a deep case of burnout. Paralegals did not type. This was a kind of rallying cry. Nonetheless, I often coveted the jobs of the secretaries who did, for if they stayed after five, they were paid overtime, and the kind of mindless typing they did looked restful to me. I, meanwhile, had to organize documents, which fell under the category of exhibit preparation, and murmuring into a dictaphone to digest depositions into a kind of telegraphic code. W can't recall palm to din with stuts. Reducing the testimony of deposed witnesses to what was optimistically called its essence. I also had to make the occasional and terrifying court appearance to get an adjournment on a motion. This is now almost always done by attorneys, but in the 70s, Manhattan paralegals were a cheap substitute. In this city, you would make more money as a paraplegic than a paralegal, I was continually told by one of the associates. I was 21, and mute with shyness. Up until this point in my life, I had lived only in tiny towns in northern New York. The mid-sized midtown firm I worked for comprised a dozen lawyers, all Jewish, all men, with names like Ira and Julian, which to a provincial ear did not even properly sound like boys' names. The staff was not Jewish. The goyim served, grumblingly and winkingly. Everyone smoked and drank too much coffee. My boss, the senior partner, had apparently made his name with a big case for Sears Roebuck in the 1940s, and he had coasted on this reputation for years. With his money, he bought antiquarian books, boxes of which he ripped open hungrily when they arrived, as well as some Calder prints, which he displayed in the firm's lobby, and which made a big impression on me. His clients still tended to be department stores, and the case he had me working on involved the firing of the chairman of Bonwit Teller, whose makeup counters I dreamily visited during lunch hours. My boss was alternately tetchy and expansive. He spoke loudly and crazily, as all bosses in my experience from summer jobs did. By the time I came on board, he was also a little hard of hearing. When after 2 years I told him I was leaving for graduate school in writing, he thought I'd said riding and made a crack about horses. But this is what my first real job brought me. What I thought of as my first grown-up friend. A lawyer 15 years my senior, who remains my friend to this day. And though I envied the chicly dressed young women who worked in the Pace Gallery and at Cambridge University Press, housed in the same building and sharing the elevators, my own exquisitely wrong job did bring me, for a brief period, a life in Manhattan. Improvised, lonely, exhilarating. I lived on 18th Street and 1st Avenue, above a restaurant, and was always broke, though it was middle-class poverty, temporary, part of youth and art, more a game to be played than a deep condition. It produced in me an eccentric economy. Tired from work and fearful of the subways at night, I would get into a cab and say, "Give me $1.50's worth, please," then hop out at Murray Hill. I had one suit, which I wore all week. The jacket on Monday with slacks, the skirt on Tuesday with a blouse, the jacket and skirt together at last on Wednesday, and so on. I ate hamburgers but not cheeseburgers, which cost 10 cents more. Still, I spent $25 to see Bette Midler on Broadway, and another $25 to see Liza Minnelli at Carnegie Hall. I was like a 14-year-old gay boy escaped to the bright big city from the farm, which is perhaps what, in my heart, given even the slimmest of paychecks, I continue to be. 2001. Frederick Cassidy. Although Fred Cassidy, linguistic historian, detective, and bard, was a colleague of mine, I didn't really know him. When I first arrived at the University of Wisconsin 16 years ago as an assistant professor, soon dividing my year between the futon on a friend's Madison sun porch and a sparsely furnished Hell's Kitchen rat shop 900 miles east, Professor Cassidy had long been a distinguished figure in the English department, already officially emeritus, an eminence, a sprightly and regal widower, who lived atop a hill in a stately brick home coveted by a perennially house-hunting friend of mine. He presided over what the department called DARE, well before the acronym took on its current drug awareness meaning. DARE, the Dictionary of American Regional English, was a gargantuan, decades-long project, then housed several offices down from mine, and was always spoken of in astonished and reverential tones. My first week of teaching, I was shown the closed door of the busy DARE office and told solemnly, "They are still only on C." To capture in a single reference book all of American local idiom seems a brilliant folly, like, say, maniacal lepidopterology or the corking of breezes in bottles, as well as a practical, useful item it's amazing someone didn't think of before. The pages of the actual dictionary, which in its published form is now 3 volumes long and up to the letter O, are full of whimsy and science, maps and pronunciation guides, and a neutral fascination with words for their own sake, whether they be offensive, improper, gorgeous, or odd, from bladderpod to cattywampus to ollicook. The vanishing names for our vanishing natural world abound in DARE's pages. All manner of flora and fauna are richly retrieved. It is sometimes like taking a walk in the woods just paging through the book. The everyday words for our everyday lives are the target of the research, but with its penetrating fieldwork, the project's historical and geographical reach illumines the story of a country forged under the most disparate and occasionally half-forgotten of influences. In comprehending his tireless devotion to this linguistic enterprise, it is tempting to psychologize or metaphorize Cassidy's own background. What Kingston-born son of a Jamaican mother and a Canadian father, who then grew up to marry a French woman in Michigan, would not have been constantly sorting out and deciphering the vernacular of various places, interrogating the idiomatic phrases that must have flown around him incessantly, enticingly, bewilderingly? Language, surely, was a daily family matter for young Fred Cassidy, and in trying to capture and locate it regionally, to make a hunting and gathering of it, perhaps he most resembles his fellow islander, John James Audubon, who also set out to capture in its natural habitat a colorful winged thing and bring it to the pages of a book for study. At university gatherings, when I happened to spy Professor Cassidy, He seemed always to be excitedly hazarding a guess about the origins of someone's name, usually the name of the person to whom he was talking, who would listen, rapt and flattered. He came to my office only once, wearing one of his pale suits, not a staple of Midwestern academic attire, but a staple of his. "Who is your literary agent?" he asked. I was taken aback by the sheer business of it, but told him her name, and he wrote it down. Then he looked up. "I have a book I am writing about my life," he said, smiling boyishly and dreamily. "And I'm going to go to New York, take her out to lunch, and tell her about it." I don't know precisely what happened to that memoir, although I'm told it was never completed. The book that, of course, remains the story of his life is there, with its rousing, perfect title for a life story. "On to Z," was Fred's characteristically buoyant cry, one with which he liked to close letters, exit a conversation, depart a room. "Don't feel constricted by the life," I was advised by the New York Times Magazine upon agreeing to write this appreciation of Professor Cassidy. Perhaps it forgot that I, too, am a Wisconsin academic, or perhaps it was remembering. But when one contemplates Fred Cassidy's life, constricted is not what one feels, nor is crimpled, nor is hindered. Not, as is said chiefly in scattered regions of the South, hardly. 2001. Alice Munro's Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage. "Love never dies," says a character from Alice Munro's 1994 collection, Open Secrets. And the woman listening to him feels impatient to the point of taking offense. "This is what all the speech-making turns you into," she thinks, "a person who can say things like that. Love dies all the time." The birth and death of erotic love, and the strange places people are led to because of it, on the lookout for an insanity that could contain them, as it is put in Vandals, another story in that same collection, is Munro's timeless subject. In her new collection, Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, showing that the impulse toward love, if not love itself, dies hard, she follows her characters' erotic lives straight through the chemotherapy ward, into the nursing home, on into the funeral parlor. In The Bear Came Over the Mountain, a faithless husband puts his wife into a nursing home, only to watch her acquire there a new wheelchaired beau. In Family Furnishings, a woman in a nursing home incessantly chants, "Fit as a fiddle and ready for love." In Floating Bridge, a terminally ill woman is led out into the woods for a kiss by a strange young boy who is both god of love and angel of death. Munro would naturally see these figures entwined. In Comfort, the protagonist has a romantic encounter with an undertaker, whose activities of bloodletting and body cavity drainage, like those of the taxidermist lover in Vandals, suggest perhaps one darkly funny opinion of Munro's regarding the drama of love. The narrator of Queenie, surrounded by couples, each with its own heat and disturbance, notes her own desire for solitude, "for there was nothing I could see in their lives to instruct me or encourage me." Like Henry James, Alice Munro knows that love's floating bridge between worlds and over swamps can bring a ruinous fate as easily and indifferently as can its absence. But Munro also knows that the arranging of love, improvised or institutional, and the seismic upheavals of its creation and dismantling, the boards rising and falling precariously beneath the feet, is both a kind of pornography of life and the very truth of it. It is often the most persuasive and defining force in the shape of individual existence and individual fate. Not that this is to be valued or judged. In Munro's world, there is a powerlessness before the whole matter, only that such a thing is to be maturely understood and perceptively watched. "Their marriages were the real content of their lives," she writes in Comfort, the sometimes harsh and bewildering, indispensable content of her life. Unlike James, a permanent tourist in the land of marriage and romantic union, a subject endlessly suited to the short story genre. Monroe is intimately informed about what actually goes on there, and it is but one of the many reasons she is, to speak historically, and to speak even, say, in a Russian or French or Irish saloon, loudly and unarmed, one of the world's greatest short story writers. As the writer Ethan Kanan once said, "The stories of Alice Munro make everyone else's look like the work of babies." She is also interested in social class, and there is not one of her stories in this new book that does not put together characters with real, if subtle, class divisions between them. This Munro does with a neutral, unsentimental eye and limber sympathies. In the stories she tells, a character's passage across these divisions may be thwarted or assisted by love, or by ambition, or by art, or by the tiniest imperceptible sorts of revolutions enacted in loneliness, or conspiracy, or both. She has a vision of the world that is like a novelist's, and a typical Alice Munro story contains a novel's breadth and satisfactions in miniature, fitted in like a ship in a bottle or a beautiful bonsai tree. Because she tends toward the long story and writes with a long view of life as well, time is both her subject and her medium, its mysteries and flukes both pondered and employed. Her narratives leap and U-turn through time, and the actual subject and emotion of a story may be deferred in such gymnastic travel, or may be multiple or latent. The particular and careful ways Munro's themes are laid into her narrative trajectories cause them to sneak up upon the reader. They surprise, like the rogue but graceful syntax of a complex wine. Possibly there will be some consensus among her readers on the new collection's weak link, as well as its crown jewel. As to the former, the title story may come under the most fire, but it is here that Munro lays out one of her signature themes, the random permanent fate brought about by an illusion of love. The story proceeds at first like a ronde, passing its point of view from a peripheral train station agent to a Scottish housekeeper buying a ticket, on through the various characters, the housekeeper's former employer, the employer's shoemaker, the shoemaker's daughter, the daughter's friend, who is the housekeeper's former charge, who all have some bearing on the outcome of the story. A fictitious epistolary courtship is staged by the two girls, who have only random mischief on their minds, but it sets in motion a real marriage between the Scottish housekeeper and her employer's former son-in-law, replete with a baby named Omar. "For where," thinks the young, undiscovered author of the love letters, "on the list of things she planned to achieve in her life, was there any mention of her being responsible for the existence on earth of a person named Omar?" The remark contains Munro's sly amusement at how things turn out between men and women. Her heart had been dry, and she had considered it might always be so, and now such a warm commotion, such busy love. As does the awkward title, which is the girl's game of writing down the letters of a boy's name, then ticking off the counted number on your fingers saying, "Hateship, friendship, courtship, loveship, marriage," till you get the verdict on what could happen between you and that boy. The title by the end loses its ungainliness, acquires much rightness for explicitly announcing the collection's themes, one of which is the power of writing itself, and in the end seems oddly perfect, as does the story's focus on the doings of young girls, for it is the first story in a book whose final one completes the picture with a stark, wicked, and moving tale of old age. In this last story, the bear came over the mountain. Fiona, the beloved but mentally ailing wife of a retired literature professor named Grant, is condemned to the hell of a nursing home. It's dribblers, head wagglers, mad chatterers. And like Rilke's Eurydice, she there grows indifferent to her earthly husband, a little forgetful of him, even falling in love with a fellow resident instead. She is vague but courteous when her husband comes to visit, always turning her attention back to her new companion, Aubrey. This new love involves a retrieval of a lost thread from her past, a predilection of Munro's stories. The past rises up and breathes out ghost after ghost. since Fiona knew Aubrey when she was young, had even gone out with him once, before some arbitrariness on the part of her father interrupted their courtship. Now she has him again, at last, albeit in a wheelchair, and they have, in a sweetly demented and embarrassing way, become smitten. That Grant, during their marriage, had routinely been unfaithful to Fiona is both ironic and fortunate. Nowhere was there any acknowledgement that the life of a philanderer, if that was what Grant had to call himself, involved acts of kindness and generosity and even sacrifice. Monroe writes both hilariously and seriously. For when Fiona's well-being is threatened by Aubrey's removal from Meadow Lake by his buxom wife, Marion, Grant has the largeness of heart and the convenient old sexual habits to ensure something better for his wife, whom he does, in fact, deeply love, and so proves. The past resurfaces challengingly in other stories here, such as Nettles, where the newly divorced narrator, while visiting her friend Sonny, encounters her old girlhood sweetheart, the son of the local well driller, sitting in Sonny's kitchen, making his characteristic ketchup sandwich, one of Monroe's many clues of childhood deprivation survived. He is a fellow guest there, as the narrator observes, and the coincidence which their hosts might think remarkable was to us a comically dazzling flare-up of good fortune. Their attraction knows its bounds, however, and nothing romantic comes of it. The story concludes that it was love that was not usable, that knew its place. Some would say not real because it would never risk getting its neck wrung or turning into a bad joke or sadly wearing out. Not risking a thing yet staying alive as a sweet trickle, an underground resource, with the weight of this new stillness on it, this seal. I never asked Sonny for news of him, or got any, during all the years of our dwindling friendship. This swift and economical use of the word dwindling, thriftily closing two stories at once, is Monroe at her crafty best. Arguably the finest story in hateship, friendship, courtship, loveship, marriage, and surely one of several here that are among the most powerful stories she has written, Family Furnishings is less about love as fate and more an ambivalent, even bitter exploration of the spiritual escape and emotional cost of becoming a writer. Writing is often construed more generally in Monroe too, and plots that turn on notes and letters abound in her work, this collection containing three such stories. About this subject, there is not a more moving piece by anyone that I can think of. Family Furnishings is written in the first person, and in it the narrator focuses her recollections on Elfrida, one of the career girls slash aunt figures that have made their appearance from the beginning of Monroe's work, from Fern in Lives of Girls and Women, 1971, to Polly in Post and Beam, or also in this new book, Queenie, in the story of the same name. They are women who lose their significance to the heroine as they get older and clearer in their sadnesses, but who hold a glamour for her when she is young and in need of emissaries from the world outside her immediate family. Elfrida is only, in the most general sense, a writer. She is a small-town journalist. One of the people who wrote under the name of Flora Simpson on the Flora Simpson Housewives page. Women from all over the countryside believed that they were writing their letters to the plump woman with the crimped gray hair and the forgiving smile who was pictured at the top of the page. But the truth, which I was not to tell, was that the notes that appeared at the bottom of each of their letters were produced by Elfrida and a man she called Horse Henry, who otherwise did the obituaries. She also writes under her own name, Round and About the Town with Elfrida. She is the narrator's father's cousin, and more like a close sister to him, since her own mother was killed in the kerosene lamp accident. This accident, and its effect on Elfrida, which Monroe describes briefly, as if in passing, is in some ways the emotional heart of the story. You're just better off not to see her. You would not want to see her if you knew what she looked like now, a grandmother tells the young, wailing Elfrida while her mother is dying in the next room. And Elfrida cries, "But she would want to see me." Elfrida herself does not understand her own story and says, "I must have thought I was a pretty big cheese, mustn't I? She would want to see me." But the narrator does understand, and a writer is born. She says, "And the minute that I heard it, something happened. It was as if a trap had snapped shut to hold these words in my head. She would want to see me. The story I wrote with this in it would not be written till years later, not until it had become quite unimportant to think about who had put the idea into my head in the first place." When the narrator goes off to college in the city where Elfrida lives, she only visits her once, mostly not returning her phone calls. The narrator's new fiancé shows little interest in her cousin Elfrida. He admired opera and Laurence Olivier's Hamlet, but he had no time for tragedy, for the squalor of tragedy in ordinary life. His resolute approval of me did not extend to my ramshackle background. And so Elfrida drifts away, her affair with a married man amounting to little. At the time of the narrator's father's death, she sits half-cracked in a nursing home. It is years earlier from her father, and then later from Elfrida's daughter, put up for adoption at birth, that the narrator learns of Elfrida's distress at seeing her life used in her young cousin's published writing. The narrator gives the writer's standard defense. "It wasn't Elfrida at all. I changed it. I wasn't even thinking about her. It was a character. Anybody could see that." But as a matter of fact, there was still the exploding lamp, the mother in her charnel wrappings, the staunch, bereft child. To escape the claustrophobic anti-intellectualism of Elfrida and her world, who see real literature as pretentious hotshot reading, the narrator cut short her one lone visit with her cousin and, walking back to her student apartment, stops to spend an hour in a drugstore drinking coffee instead. It is an act of both betrayal and survival, and it expresses at its core the literary impulse. Here Munro's writing ascends like Isolde. "The coffee was reheated, black and bitter. Its taste was medicinal, exactly what I needed. I was already feeling relieved, and now I began to feel happy. Such happiness to be alone, to see the hot late afternoon light on the sidewalk outside, the branches of a tree just out in leaf, throwing their skimpy shadows. To hear from the back of the shop the sounds of the ball game that the man who had served me was listening to on the radio. I did not think of the story I would make about Elfrida, not of that in particular, but of the work I wanted to do, which seemed more like grabbing something out of the air than constructing stories. The cries of the crowd came to me like big heartbeats full of sorrows. Lovely, formal-sounding waves, with their distant, almost inhuman assent and lamentation. This was what I wanted. This was what I thought I had to pay attention to. This was how I wanted my life to be." This gorgeous Liebestod should not be mistaken for resounding affirmation of the literary life, but understood instead as an acknowledgement of its emotional distances and thefts and its willing trade of the human for art. It is a song of relief alloyed with shame. Munro has beautifully registered the ambivalent conscience of the writer, not judgmentally but helplessly, as before love, and the life story love brings before dying. 2002. Edna St. Vincent Millay. The photograph of the mutable Edna St. Vincent Millay that peers out from the cover of Nancy Milford's new biography recalls the face of a Vermeer, but not a Vermeer painted in the likely way. Upside down, via camera obscura, so the features and creamy surfaces come together abstractly with the sweet extraterrestrial look of sainthood or Down syndrome. The portrait on the cover of Milford's book, despite the tortured Flemish flapper coif, beneath which sits the elegant bone structure and porcelain finish of a teapot, is mesmerizingly human. Millet's unaverted gaze is seen right side up, captured not as a collection of abstract qualities, but as part of the living, breathing features of a complex and elusive woman. And so it is with Milford's biography. Neither empirical nor worshipful, Savage Beauty, the life of Edna St. Vincent Millay, bears up under its 20-odd years of research and deluge of detail to manage a rich, moving picture of a rich, moving target. Milford, the author of a celebrated biography of Zelda Fitzgerald, has assembled her portrait of Millay largely from bundles of documents kept for decades by Millay's literary executor and less-than-industrious sister Norma, who died in 1986 at the age of 93. And sensitive to the literary significance of her subject and the impact of this biography in revisiting, if not securing, Millay's historical importance, Milford's decades of excavation and narrative piecework have paid off in something slightly, perhaps inevitably, disorganized as well as original and spellbinding. Millay was the second renowned American poet to spend years in a city called Camden, though hers was in Maine. She was petite, intense, bright, witty, romantic, freckled, auburn-haired, self-dramatizing, and beautiful. As a poet friend recently remarked to me, why has Judy Davis not yet played her in the movie? At one time arguably the most famous living poet in the world, her work lauded by Thomas Hardy, Eleanor Wiley, Edmund Wilson, Sarah Teasdale, and Louise Bogan, Millay lived stormily and wrote unevenly, so that her place in American letters was in descent even in her lifetime. In her day, she was hailed as a feminist lyric voice of the jazz age, yet she went largely unclaimed by the feminism of subsequent decades. She owned, perhaps, too many evening gowns, and her poems may have had an excess of voiceless golden birds. She did not strain for her metaphors. On her mantelpiece at home were two gold bird figurines, souvenirs from a trip to Asia. Her work could be occasionally modernist, but only occasionally, and so was not taken up by the champions of modernism, with their passion for Pound and for Eliot, of whom Millay once wrote a murderous satire. Of E.E. Cummings she once wrote, "Powerful writing, as well as some of the most pompous nonsense I ever let slip to the floor with a wide yawn." Her reputation, despite her sharp critical mind, enormous popularity, and a Pulitzer Prize, she was the first woman to win one, suffered for these exclusions. A gifted formalist and prolific sonneteer, a literary heir to Donne, Wordsworth, Byron, and, well, Christina Rossetti, Millay today has been admired only slightly or reluctantly, if at all. Her poetry viewed, sometimes by its detractors as well as its devotees, as anachronistic, unreconstructedly Victorian, sentimental, recycled. Even the critic Colin Falk, who writes in his impassioned introduction to her selected poems, that the occulting of Millay's reputation has been one of the literary scandals of the 20th century, nonetheless finds only a quarter of her poems worthy enough to entitle her to consideration as one of the major poets of the century. Such lilting lyrics as, "And better friends I'll not be knowing, still there's no train I'd not get on no matter where it's going," or, "We were very tired, we were very merry, we had gone back and forth all night on the ferry," which would have burnished the lyrical reputation of such ironists as Bob Dylan and Philip Larkin, did not seem especially to add to hers. A quarter, however, is probably not bad, probably usual for a major poet, and in Millay's case, probably high. One can see scattered throughout her poems, some weak and famous, some stronger and lesser known, enough elegant and beautiful lines so that one wonders what she was thinking in the rest of the too often soggy poem. Her sonnets are especially susceptible to this. She wrote them as a short story writer constructs a story, with the end strongly in mind. Between the Petrarchan and Shakespearean sonnet, the latter, with its dramatic closing couplet, is sometimes considered the more vulgar of the two, and it was at these that Millay excelled. The pseudo-feminist, "I shall forget you presently, my dear," closes cleverly. But so it is, and nature has contrived to struggle on without a break thus far. Whether or not we find what we are seeking is idle, biologically speaking. I think I should have loved you presently, ends with this rhythmic mock mournfulness. A ghost in marble of a girl you knew who would have loved you in a day or two. Other of Millais' endings involve such epigrammatic wisdom as, let us go forth together to the spring. Love must be this if it be anything. I pray you, if you love me, bear my joy. And, pity me that the heart is slow to learn what the swift mind beholds at every turn. Pity me not because the light of day. If she had gone into commercial songwriting, she might have been praised more enduringly as a poet. Among her more ad-lib verse, Wild Swans and Elegy, From Memorial to D.C., have particular strength. The former, one of her simplest, shortest, and best compositions, is straightforward and affecting in its swell of feeling and cry of exile. I looked in my heart while the wild swans went over. And what did I see I had not seen before? Only a question less or a question more. Nothing to match the flight of wild birds flying. Tiresome heart, forever living and dying, house without air, I leave you and lock your door. Wild swans, come over the town again, trailing your legs and crying. Contemporary critics often praise Bluebeard, a first-rate sonnet written sympathetically from the point of view of the merely private, though disobeyed, husband. I must never more behold your face. This now is yours. I seek another place. Long before Anne Sexton's transformations, Millais was boldly looking twice at literature's alleged villains and staking out radical positions for herself. But Milford is mistaken that the mawkish and folksy Ballad of the Harp Weaver, also a kind of fairy tale and inspired by and dedicated to Millais' mother, is a terrific poem. Its wearying 29 stanzas begin, Son, said my mother when I was knee-high, you've need of clothes to cover you, and not a rag have I. And so on. Milford is understandably moved that last June in New York City, she overheard two girls on MacDougall Street reciting it by heart. Surely in that context one would be moved even to hear There Was a Young Lady of Niger. But that cannot change the quality of Millais' too mortal poem, the sentimental doggerel of which makes it probably indeed best suited to children. The poem's attachment to themes of maternal self-sacrifice in the Millais family give it power for Milford, for whom, naturally, biographical readings are the interesting ones. That Millais' mother might have written it herself is never mentioned, though such a thought did occur to me. As a result, we have, with Milford's biography, the story of the life that eclipsed the work. It is a life that began in bookish poverty. Millais' mother, an itinerant nurse and hair weaver, one is reminded slightly here of a Victorian update of the medieval barber surgeon, also kept a room full of books open as a kind of public reading space for the neighborhood schoolchildren. It was a larger and finer collection than that possessed by the local library. Mrs. Millais herself, however, was rarely home. Her three beautiful daughters, a phrase already out of a fairy tale, largely looked after themselves, constructing a childhood of work and magic, fusing chores with skits. They memorized and performed poetry and songs, enchanting all who heard, or almost all. Edna, the eldest, known as Vincent, after St. Vincent's Hospital, where a relative was convalescing at the time of her birth, or Cepheus or Cephe to her mother, short for Josephus, for her role as alto and son, and perhaps caretaker of the younger girls, the faux aliases the family concocted for themselves were a stewpot of loopy nicknames, was also the most beautiful, the most enchanting, and the most gifted. She was the leader of the sisters' imaginative play, as well as primary housekeeper. When the river in Camden overflowed and the weather turned cold, Milford tells us, The kitchen floor flooded and froze, and the girls gleefully ice skated across it. There is a melancholy echo of this game in the last year of Millay's life, when a caretaker at her upstate New York home of Steepletop recalls of the ill and recently widowed Millay. "I remember that I had to wax the floor, and I asked her where the heavy polisher was to buff it, and she sort of smiled at me, and putting on her socks, she skated and danced across my freshly waxed floor, and did it shine." Even as a girl, she calculated her effect and cut a magical figure. One childhood friend recalls her opening the door one evening dressed in a blouse of white muslin with cuffs and boned collar made of rows of insertion edged with lace. A full-gored skirt came to the top of her buttoned boots. A patent leather belt circumscribed a wide equator around her tiny middle, and a big blue bow spread its wings behind her head, where her hair was fastened in a bun. Books were piled on the floor from a table Vincent had cleared for games, and in the center was a plate of still-warm fudge. When it came time to leave, she showed her guests to the door, lamp in hand, and taking up the refrain of the last song she'd sung for them, sang out, "Adieu, adieu, kind friends, adieu." She has built up so enormous an image of herself as the enchanted little fairy princess, recalled another friend much later in life. She is the oddest mixture of genius and childish vanity, open-mindedness and blind self-worship that I have ever known. In American mythological terms, Millay's is an actress's childhood, drunken absent father, divorced ambitious stage mother, a dreamy desire for the theater manifest everywhere from her reinvented speech and musical numbers with her sisters to her passion for sewing and costumes. She was a lifelong clothes horse, not for her the fate of the redhead resigned to only Kelly Green. All the while, she wrote poems, stories, even two novels, one written when she was 8, the other at 15. Eventually, she would also write an opera, The King's Henchman, which would have its premiere at the Metropolitan Opera House in 1927. She read all of Tennyson, Milton, Wordsworth, Longfellow, Shakespeare, Keats, Shelley, and Coleridge, and practiced and composed piano pieces. She was given early to dramatic recitations of the many poems she memorized, and she memorized her own poems first, composing them in her head before she wrote them down, a habit she kept throughout her lifetime. This habit of public recitation was responsible for an early turning point in her life when at 20 she presented her own poetry at a summer hotel where her sister Norma worked, and a potential benefactress, Carolyn Dow, became smitten and promised to send her to Vassar. Vincent was also offered by another benefactress free tuition to Smith, which she turned down. Such was her magical effect on people. There was no protracted, lonely obscurity for her. Almost from the beginning, she was noticed and sponsored. Even when her first famous poem, Renaissance, did not win a prize in the then widely read journal, The Lyric Year, it became a kind of cause célèbre because it hadn't. Various readers and poets registering their dissent, and the actual first place winner refusing his prize money. Millay's failure to win the contest had been preceded by a long, coquettish, perhaps scandalous correspondence with one of the editors and judges, Ferdinand Earle, which her brazen flirtation in the end leading nowhere useful, concluded with her writing to him in bitter disappointment. "Let me congratulate you on your convincing impersonation of a genuine man. How can I be expected to understand a person who got his education in France, his business methods in Siberia, his behavior in vaudeville, and his brains in a raffle?" It is a loss to the occasion of this mini-revival of Millay that her correspondence, first published in part in the 50s by her sister Norma, has not also been issued, for Millay's prose is sparkling and fierce, on a par with Dorothy Parker's, to whom she was occasionally in her time compared. Although she was already 20 when she started college, and therefore older than the others, among the young Vassar girls, too, Malay became a kind of pet. Girls fell in love with her, and it was with them she first began, necessarily or gratuitously. Malay's cruelties are hard to categorize, breaking the hearts of people infatuated with her. She was a master of the sudden distance as well as the sudden intimacy, but she was also a discreet and loyal friend, which, if her lovers could forgivingly manage such a friendship, and Edmund Wilson later on was one of these, proved a lifelong reward. Strong-willed and ambivalent about student life that did not involve her poetry, Malay bore up under the strictures of Vassar and the sternness of the hypermanagerial Miss Dow, her benefactress, though not without bumpiness. Malay was already famous and feeling hemmed in by the regulations of the college. For skipping classes, she was both rescued and reprimanded by Vassar's president. "I don't want any dead Shelleys on my doorstep," he said to her. "On those terms," she replied cockily, "I think I can continue to live in this hellhole." "I hate this pink and gray college," she wrote in a letter to a friend. "If there had been a college in Alice in Wonderland, it would be this college. They treat us like an orphan asylum. I am thinking seriously of going to the University of Moscow and taking a course in polite anarchy and murder as a fine art." Her brief suspension, shortly before graduation, was met with much protest from admiring students and professors. She had been the star of all the class plays and written to herself. She was a kind of beloved student queen and had trouble deferring to anyone, doing pretty much as she pleased. "I want you different from the usual type of poet who claims a freedom bordering on license," Miss Dow wrote to her scoldingly when Malay missed a meeting with one of Dow's distinguished friends. Throughout her life, people initially saw in Malay what they wanted to see, then later were disabused. When her first book was published, Malay sent one to Miss Dow, only to receive this stinging note. "Of course I am happy to have an author's copy and hope it is only the beginning of better things. If I had not heard from several sources how bored you have been in the atmosphere of our home, I would have been glad to have you bring Norma up to dinner sometime, but I hate to suggest a return to a place which seems to have been dull." She added paradoxically that Malay would always be as welcome as when we were all you had. After Vassar, Malay headed for Greenwich Village, where she wrote and, along with her sisters and mother, performed with the Provincetown Players. Her play, Aria da Capo, which she directed, was a resounding success. She traveled to France, England, and Albania, and helped keep things afloat financially by writing pseudonymously for Vanity Fair under the name of Nancy Boyd, reporting and advising on the social scene around her. Her many lovers included the most attractive of her political and artistic crowd: Floyd Dell, Edmund Wilson, John Peel Bishop, probably Jack Reed, probably Malcolm Cowley. She also had an affair with Thelma Wood, Juna Barnes's lover, earning Barnes's lifelong jealousy, and once made a pass at Georgia O'Keeffe, which was rebuffed. Wilson strangely attributed Malay's promiscuity to her having had a delayed start on sex. This despite her many lovers at Vassar — he didn't count girls — and despite that he was a virgin himself before he met Malay, who was his age, and so had gotten a much later start than she. Inconsequentially, one imagines. But maybe too much, generally, has been made of Malay's love affairs. Daniel Mark Epstein, in a strange arithmetical moment in his biography of Malay, puts the official count at 100, with the implication that the unofficial tally would be much higher. The most important person in her life was not really any of them. Nor was it exactly her mother, though this is occasionally asserted by her biographers, and certainly there was an intensity and love between Malay and her mother, who, however, often seems more like yet another admirer, steeped in yearning, her letters to her daughter full of a lover's phrases and begging. The hard-working and literate Cora Malay had been for Vincent less a mother than a sister, coach, and friend. She kept close tabs on Vincent's work and publications, and even competed with Vincent in poetry contests, being something of a poet herself. This close mother-daughter literary bond is perhaps rivaled in American letters only by Carson McCullers and her mother, who was sometimes suspected of writing her young daughter's work. Neither Epstein nor Milford reports any such suspicion here, though it is interesting to note that in both McCullers and Millay's cases, the writer's work went into conspicuous decline after the mother's death. Cora shared with everyone else an undying infatuation with Vincent. She was at times less stage mother than president of the fan club, wondering, it seemed, how she, a mere mortal, could have given birth to such a goddess. But she was not without her own ego, vis-a-vis her daughter, once writing, "We all know the poet who shot into fame as Edna St. Vincent Millay. But who was the poet who gave her the name of Edna St. Vincent Millay?" Vincent perhaps did as much to care for Cora later on in life, bringing her to Paris, buying her a house, as Cora had ever done for her. Edmund Wilson's recollection of Vincent's mother included her once saying that she had been a slut herself, so why shouldn't her girls be? Wilson found Mrs. Millay shocking, but felt that even more than with Edna, Cora had passed beyond good and evil, and that she had attained there a certain gaiety. Perhaps it would not have been possible for her daughters to love Cora in any conventional way. Their adult protectiveness toward her was more likely a forgiving cover for her prior maternal negligence. She was at times hectoring and emotionally demanding. She had sent their father away, divorcing him, after developing a crush on a local minister. She consigned to her eldest astonishing quantities of housework. She gave her daughters a book on witchcraft, which, in the absence of parental care, became a kind of Bible to them. She was a self-invented herbalist who made Vincent quite ill with a potion designed for homemade abortions. The daughters vied for her attention, courting her and looking after her, but when, as an older woman, she became more available to them, they plotted their little escapes from her. When Vincent writes to her, "We all love you better than anything, just as we did when we were little kids," one hears more obligation and desperation and hollowly constructed reassurance than truth. No, surely the great love of Millay's life and the great mother was her husband, the Dutch aristocrat Eugène Boissevin, whose former wife was the suffragist Inez Milholland, also a Vassar graduate who died tragically at 28. Boissevin was, according to Millay's brother-in-law, the solution to a lot of problems for Millay. He was the mother type, and in terms of continuous devotion and care, a more effective parent to Millay than her own parents ever were. As literary husbands go, even Leonard Wolfe may pale by comparison. Boissevin loved caring for Millay and boasted of it. He called her Vince, just as Millay boasted, "I have nothing to do with my household. Agendas, all that sort of thing. I have no time for it. I want to go into my dining room as if it were a restaurant and say, 'What a charming dinner.' It's this unconcern with my household that protects me from the things that eat up a woman's time and interest." Millay and Boissevin married when she was scheduled for intestinal surgery, and his official spousal status was required for visitation. They gathered together with a few witnesses at his house in Croton-on-Hudson. She threw mosquito netting over her head for a veil, and immediately afterward they drove to New York Hospital. It was an open marriage. Each had affairs known to the other. Hers with the poet George Dillon seems even to have been actively encouraged by Boissevin. But theirs remained nonetheless a close and rancorless union. As he had squired his first famous wife on her speaking tours, Boissevin accompanied and nursed Millay on her grand whistle-stop readings. She read to nothing but packed houses, and generally saw her through illness, spiritual crises, and family dramas, especially with her youngest sister Kathleen, who was by then severely alcoholic. When they hit financial difficulties, Boissevin remained characteristically buoyant. He wrote to his brother that he was down to his last dollar, but needed it for magic tricks. Millay's wit, too, remained undeterred by money issues. She wrote of her publishers, from whom she borrowed large sums, Although I reject their proposals, I welcome their advances. When her husband died during surgery for lung cancer, Millay was, of course, devastated. Her own actual death, a fall down the stairs, seems a drunken suicide. She was not without such tendencies, a leap that perhaps